Thanks, Philippe. So I just need to say as well, thank you to the other conference committee members, because this obviously wasn't just my work. Cassandra Extervoor, David Benison, Greg Huber, and Lars Bildenstein, who also played a big role in getting us all together. So really, I want to tell you about how complexity might have emerged at the very beginning of life, very similar to what Niles has just been speaking about, and also how programmed death might have emerged using our model system. So this talk is going to be in two parts. The first two-thirds, I'm going to be speaking and telling you about what programmed cell death is, how it's affected, and maybe why it might exist at all, and summarize some of the data that we have at the moment, which gives us clues as to how this might be playing out. And then I'm just going to introduce our particular model system that we're using to study life's origins, the approach that we're using, and then I'm going to hand over to Nisha Dhar, who's going to summarize the experiments that we're doing in our lab. So the first thing is that you get two ways of dying. There's programmed death and there's non-programmed death. And I'm really speaking about unicellular eukaryotes here. I'm not a specialist in prokaryotes. So certainly unicellular eukaryotes, wherever it's been looked for in a diverse range of lineages, we have found programmed cell death. How do we detect it? It's a complex biochemical process. There are lots of assays, and there are lots of, not lots of different phenotypes, but you can detect it in lots of different ways. So you need to be very careful about what you're thinking about when you're speaking about programmed cell death. It's a point I want to make at the start. And then, of course, the really interesting question is, why does it exist when it's got this absolute fitness cost to the actor? And as usual, there are going to be two possible solutions. So what we did is we examined the fitness effects of programmed death on others. And so what I just need to tell you as well is the difference between programmed and non-programmed death. Programmed death, of which there are several phenotypes, the most commonest phenotype is this one, apoptosis. And it is energy dependent, it's an active process, genes are turned on and off, it is internally initiated. And there are many stimuli depending upon the type of unicell that you're studying. It can be UV damage, nutrient depletion, aging, oxidative stress, various compounds, and so on. And what happens is that this cell breaks up, it slowly digests itself in some ways. It breaks up into membrane-bound particles such that the intracellular cytosol is not liberated into the environment. And this is contrasted with non-programmed death, and these terms are also very tricky, but I don't have time to really go into them. Sometimes called necrosis, which is a passive, no energy requirement. It's an unregulated process to a large degree and externally stimulated. And for example, this is physicochemical damage usually. And what happens is the cell is damaged to a smaller or lesser degree, and the contents of the cell seep out into the environment. So this is the important distinction. And I've watched a lot of cells die and taken lots of photographs of what they look like when they die. I think this is the pathologist coming out in me. But here's a snapshot of what happens just before you induce programmed cell death, 2 hours afterwards, 4 or 6 hours afterwards, and then 12, 16, 18 hours afterwards. And we're using this organism again, Chlamydomonas reinhardtii, because I did my postdoc in Rick's lab and I got fascinated with these algae as well. So this is what it looks like when it's doing well. And if you induce death through various stimuli, you have a cluster of characteristic features that you can measure. For example, the cell shrinks, there is membrane blebbing, the chromatin in the nucleus condenses, there are vacuoles forming, and slowly the entire thing goes through this process to form these vesicular structures, which are then broken off and are released into the environment. And we're calling these apoptotic bodies just because they look like it in multicells, but I don't really know what they are. And one of the other features here that you can't really see at the moment is that during this process, a lot of carbohydrate and lipid bodies form. And here's to make sure that they were lipids, we stained it with Nile red. And if these are the cells, the Nile red stain is specific for fatty acids and to some degree glycerol. So what did we do? So Rick mentioned our first experiment that we did. And essentially what we did is we induced programmed cell death, and we spun down the cultures, took the supernatant of that culture and fed it to others, and compared this to the control. So we wanted to see what are the effects of the PCD supernatant on culture growth. And we found essentially that PCD supernatant in Chlamydomonas makes the cells grow faster and a greater number. So we repeated that experiment with lots of different controls and species as well. So to make sure that we weren't doing anything strange, we repeated it with two different PCD stimuli, heat as well as nutrient depletion, two independent assays of PCD, and this is very important. We used DNA laddering, and we used phosphatidylserine exposure, which is one of the features of PCD as well. And these are the two most sensitive and specific assays for PCD. And we used two measures of fitness. We counted the cell number, and we also measured the culture absorbance spectrophotometrically. And this top panel is using the PCD stimulus of heat, 42 degrees Celsius for 1 hour. We got the same results with 50 degrees Celsius for 10 minutes. And this bottom panel is nutrient depletion. And what we found, the summary of this, is that we found that if we used the same species and strain of Clammy Reinhardtii strain CC125, we found that the PCD supernatant enhanced the fitness of cells that we gave the PCD fitness, the PCD supernatant to. And these are two measures of that fitness. If we gave it to a different species, Clammy Mowisii, it actually decreased the growth, and really substantially. And there might be other reasons for this, which we can discuss, but that is what we observed. We also did the same thing with Clammy Debriani. It also decreased the growth of the culture. And when we used Reinhardtii, same species, different strain, we got slightly mixed results. There seems to be a benefit, but it doesn't seem to be great. And we repeated these experiments using nutrient deplete medium that induced programmed cell death, and found a very similar pattern. So thinking about this, we wanted to explore something further, and we turned to a second chlorophyte, which is its sister, I think, to the clade of the Volvocales. It's known as Dunaliella, and it's known before that if you take Dunaliella and leave it in the dark, the cells undergo programmed cell death, and you come back 8 days later and it's clear. So we thought we'll try and see if we can replicate some of these data and see what else we can do in this chlorophyte. And the reason why we used it is because we wanted to explore if we if we sampled a natural environment, do we see the same thing? So my colleagues Monica Arellana sampled the Great Salt Lake, where Duni grows, and she found basically very similar results. So this graph is quite complicated, but there are two plots over here. One is the blue and one is the red. So the blue plot, if she induced programmed cell death in this chlorophyte, whether it was by heat, nutrient depletion, or carbon exhaustion, she found the same thing. You take the PCD supernatant and the cultures grow better. But there's a complication as well. You also get many of these bacteria growing within the Great Salt Lake. So what we did is we cultured the chlorophyte together with these bacteria, and found that during the nighttime, about a third of them die, whether these cultures were chlorophyte by itself or mixed culture. About a third or a half die. During the day, they re-establish themselves, grow very rapidly, and then nighttime some die and grow again and die and so on. And what we essentially figured out by radio labeling nutrients that were released during PCD is we found this kind of picture. So during the light, carbon dioxide is used for the cell to grow. When darkness begins, some of these cells undergo PCD and they release DOM, which is dissolved organic materials, mostly glycerol, but various other compounds as well. And that these can be used by DUNY itself to grow bigger. But it could also be used by the bacteria. And the bacteria recycle the carbon-containing compounds, which are then remineralized, which are then used by DUNY again. But the net effect is generally the same. Without the bacteria, this process happens faster. With the bacteria, you still get this process. So for example, light, again, it's grown by using the glycerol-containing compounds, divides, and the culture grows. And here are some of the pictures that Monica took. So here's a healthy cell, and when you induce PCD, it starts to form these granules, which when the cell eventually dies, releases these granules into the environment, which are then used either by the other cells within the population or by bacteria, which remineralize the carbon-containing compounds and then are reused by the chlorophyte. And here's another fluorescent microscopic picture of what's going on here. The limey green-colored secretory granules contain glycerol and short lipid molecules. So if we thought death was fun to study, well, if we're going to study death, let's try and figure out why we got here in the first place. So last year, we started thinking about these questions that Niles was speaking about as well. How am I doing for time? We got 10, 15 minutes, right? So 10 minutes, okay. 10 minutes, 15 minutes, thank you. Okay, so really, the starting point is we really want to define what life is. This is an extremely difficult thing to try and do. And I would refer you to a review by David Penny, which was published when 2003, I think. And he really discusses why it's so difficult to define. There are some helpful ideas. I think when NASA developed a program to find extraterrestrial life, they must have asked somebody, look, when we find this, how do we know if it's living or not? And Gerald Joyce is one of the experts, and this is the definition he gave. But as David Penny points out, there are many faults in it as well. And then, of course, Muller in 1966 was thinking about this a long time ago, and he really says that the present-day gene is the best representative of living material. I think this is not so helpful. But I came up with a few, and some which are not helpful, some which are circular, but may be helpful. So for example, if it's got a life history strategy, it must be alive. At least that means we've got some things that we can measure. So if we can measure fitness components, this system must be living. And also, this is my favorite, actually, because I think this really captures the quintessence of what life is, but maybe not very helpful. Usually, what researchers do, as David Penny points out, is that they give up. And they just list a whole lot of criteria and say, if it's doing all of these things, it must be living. So we needed to, we wanted to come up with a definition so at least we can contextualize our results and our strategies. And we came up with this. The most simple program for life is that which evolves because it has the ability to self-replicate. That's very important. And can interact with the environment, including others. And there is a huge amount of literature written about this from people in very diverse fields, mathematicians and modelers, biochemists, evolutionary biologists, and so on. And sometimes they conflict a lot. So really, we did a lot of reading, and we wanted to use an experimental system and model that can explain what we want to ask in the simplest possible way. So if we don't need proteins, we don't need proteins. If we don't need DNA, we don't need DNA. We want to use the one that has the most parsimonious explanation. And of course, we want a model system that we can work with in the lab that is in keeping with current knowledge, and also that fits into the most important framework that we have, and that is that, for example, you might read lots of material and say that life started with proteins. I don't think life as we know it started with proteins. Proteins might have been there. There might have been small peptides or so on, but within our working definition, peptides aren't living things. It must fit within the framework that we have over here. So one can also view this as an evolutionary transition in the sense that the origin of life is a transition from single replicating units to a functionally integrated collective. And this really is the first major leap in the way living systems are set up. This is truly life. And we spent a lot of time reading lots of things and picked out the most important ones. So for example, Eigen and Schuster's work around hypercycles and quasi-species really stands out as one of the fundamental starting points. No matter how you model how life started, you've got to invoke group theory. There are some models that can try and explain it without group theory, but most people accept that some degree of group theory is important to understand how single replicating units formed a primitive genome. One example of a type of group selection model is the stochastic corrector model, which was developed by Szathmary and Demeter, but there are lots of others. And of course, there are lots of other theories which try to explain how life started as well. And these are non-adaptive mechanisms, and I don't want to just dismiss them, but we're not really speaking about that here. One of the biggest problems that we have in terms of the theory side of stuff is that a lot of it is very difficult to test. How do you test this in the lab? So one of our main aims was to develop a system that we could work with. And just before Nisha tells you about her data that we have, ultimately, what we're working towards is basically what Niles, I think, was speaking about, is how do we get individual molecules to form networks such that the network can reproduce itself? Because at that point, I think we really are starting to hit that cusp of non-living living systems. And what's very important for us, the framework that we're working with, is we want to measure fitness components, because otherwise, how do we know how well things are doing? And three of the most important fitness components at the very beginning, and this I added during lunch when I was speaking to Niles because I'd forgotten about recombination. We really need to include recombination. But the ones we were thinking about was polymerization, ligation, and viability. And it is important to think about these things, which I think biochemists sometimes don't. The reason being is that if you have a molecule, replicas, if you like, that needs to reproduce itself, you've got to speak about populations to start off with. Because how can one molecule, which has a secondary and tertiary structure, which is necessary for the molecule to have its catalytic function, but for it to reproduce, it needs to unwind and be linear as a template. So one molecule is never going to be able to do that because you've got this trade-off between viability when it's really wound up, and that's important because when it's really wound up, it's lots more resistant to degradation and to chemical attack. So that's important, but it's also got to be unwound in order to act as a template. So you've got to think about this as well in terms of life history, evolution, and fitness trade-offs. So the molecules that we wanted to work with are already very complex. So Nisha's going to summarize her data now, but even the molecule that Niles is speaking about, these are complex molecules. They have lots of nucleotides. And how do you get from single nucleotides to polymers? That part has sort of been worked out. But how do you get from polymers that start to increase their own complexity? And that's a question that we were interested in.
So, okay. So basically, I we wanted to study, as Pierre said, we wanted to study emerging complexity at the very early stages of life. And to do that, we selected polymerase ribozyme R18 from the literature. This ribozyme has got the capability to extend this given primer template complex by adding up to 14 nucleotides in 24 hours. The rationale behind using this ribozyme was to work with molecules which would have been probably present at the very early stages of life, and we found this as the best candidate to work with. So our broad aim was to develop a possible framework for increase in complexity in early life. And by this, we want to say that we wanted to see the very early steps in life which contributed to the initial increase in complexity, where you had just nucleotides, some chemicals, not efficient reactions, no proteins, no DNA. And to do this, our objective was to investigate emerging complexity prior to R18 ribozyme. So just to give you a background of R18, it was developed from this catalytic core. This catalytic core has had an efficiency of polymerizing a given primer template complex by 6 nucleotides in 144 hours. It had a pretty poor fidelity, probably of 85% or so. And researchers did some mutation in this catalytic core and added this random region, which is shown in blue. And this ribozyme is now capable of adding 14 nucleotides in 24 hours. Our aim was to see whether this ribozyme can perform a less complex function. What do I mean to say by less complex function is whether it is able to add a given oligonucleotide to its own end. And secondly, whether it is able to do this in a non-template-directed fashion. So to give you a background of what work has already been done, so people have taken this ligase ribozyme, or maybe this one, and they have given a substrate to it, which is partially complementary, or maybe almost fully complementary to the body of the ribozyme. That means, in other words, I mean to say the ribozyme uses itself as a template for performing this ligation reaction. So we wanted to see whether is it possible for this R18 ribozyme to perform a function which is less complex, in other words, to ligate an oligonucleotide to itself and in a non-templated directed fashion. Also, then we wanted to see whether if we reduce the complexity of this ribozyme, is it able to perform any kind of function or not? So for this, we employed this strategy of incubating this ribozyme with a DNA RNA chimera, which was 35 nucleotides in length. It had four ribonucleotides at its 3' end, and these two were incubated. And by the virtue of the tertiary structure of the ribozyme, it ligated this DNA RNA chimera to its 5' end. And this ligated molecule was detected by reverse transcribing and then PCR amplifying using primers which were specific to the substrate at the 5' end and to the 3' end of 3' end of the ribozyme. And then the products were cloned and sequenced. So I started with the R18 polymerase ribozyme. It's a 189 nucleotides ribozyme. The red region is a catalytic core. The black region is the random region which was added. And this was able to perform this polymerization activity, as it's already mentioned in literature. And I observed that this was able to self-ligate the oligonucleotide to itself. Then I was further interested to create deletion mutants of this ribozyme. In other sense, I wanted to decrease its complexity. So we are measuring complexity basically in three forms: informational, structural, and functional complexity. So I created the deletion mutants till I went down to 75 nucleotides ribozyme, which had 25% catalytic co-deletion. And I saw that all these molecules were able to perform this activity. And in literature, if you see this, this 100 nucleotides molecule, which is just the catalytic co, is able to perform this polymerization activity of 6 nucleotides in 144 hours. So you can see the polymerized activity is pretty low here, but all these molecules retain the self-ligation activity. This is a gel picture which shows the ligation activity. So the first lane is the ligated molecules. The second lane is a control, which is just the ribozyme. So you can easily see the shift in the band, and it's seen in all the other deletion mutants. And serendipitously, during these experiments, I found a mutant which had a 62% catalytic co-deletion. This was a mutant of the full-length R18 polymerase ribozyme. And I was interested to see whether with such a major deletion in its catalytic core, is it able to perform that function or not? And I observed it was successful to perform that function. I was further interested to create, again, deletion mutants of these ribozymes. And I saw that I went down to up to 40 nucleotide sequence, which had a very simple structure of a hairpin and a 5-base pair stem. And all these structures were able to perform that function. So this is the gel picture, which shows the shift in the band, and it's there for all the deletion mutants. In summary, we found this small RNA ribozyme, which had 62% catalytic co-deletion and 100% random region deletion. It was basically you can say, a starting molecule, and it performed a very simple activity of joining an oligonucleotide to itself. Then we went up to 75 nucleotides or maybe 100 nucleotides ribozyme, which was also able to perform self-ligation reaction, and the 100 nucleotides started having some polymerization activity. And then we went up to 189 nucleotides ribozyme, which again had the self-ligation activity and had an improved polymerization activity. So our findings and claims are like this, that the R18 ribozyme is a polymerase and a self-ligase, and RS, which we found out, was very less complex, just 40 nucleotides and a 5-base pair stem. It was very less complex than the R18. And was catalytically active. Template independent ligation is possible, so it's a biochemically, energetically less a complex reaction and more possible during the primitive life. Ligation, not polymerization, was more likely to have kick-started life. And this is our part of our conceptual framework prior to emergence of replicators, individuals, networks, groups, etc. And our conceptual framework is this. It has been adapted from Durand and Michaud 2010. So I would like to acknowledge KITP Conference Committee, my group members, and our collaborators, Professor Michaud and Dr. Rashidi, and collaborators at Institute of Systems Biology. Thank you. Yes, this is the smallest ribozyme which has been formed to perform an activity like self-ligation. There has been other ribozyme which has been found, which is like 20 to 30 nucleotides in length, but it performs a ligation activity where it needs a template. It uses the body of the ribozyme as a template to perform the ligation reaction. Another ribozyme, which is like 60 nucleotides in length, performs cleavage activity. So, but that's a totally different category of ribozyme. But yeah, this is the first one.
From what I remember, the Bartel ribozyme was derived from the class 1 ligase. And I was wondering, do you think that that history was important in determining, in the fact that you're able to kind of bring it back to being a ligase, or do you think that you could take any 200 mer and you know, that does some function and turn it into a smaller molecule that does a simpler function?
Sorry, can you repeat your question?
Oh, do you think...
Bartel's ribozyme was adapted initially from a type of a ligase, so certainly not one this small. So when we started out, the big claim is that polymerization is the essential step to get life started. So basically what we wanted to know is, how do you get to that big ribozyme that could perform these functions? So we started to create these deletion mutants. At that time, we didn't know that part of it had been a ligase before. Ligation is a much simpler chemical reaction than polymerization. But the point here is that we regressed it to way beyond anything with this tiny structure, this stem loops, this stem hyphen structure at this point. And well, can work as a ligase, and I think that's the point we're making here.
Yes, actually, the class 1 ligase, yes, actually, it's operating with the same chemistry. So,
ligation. There's many ways to set ligase. Some can also ligate in a way, for example.
Yes, yes.
And there are many small ligases that have been selected frequently by Dalton and others that show that after ligation is not really an issue to be found in the run-up of RNA. But it's difficult to do it within certain context. So, in a sense, I think that some of the answers in the case of increase of complexity were already addressed, I think, between random selection on two of the sizes, finding out that more in the right design, after all, you can do chemistry, but less complex is the function in a sense that it does not allow generalization of the function
So,
part of the big problem is to explain replication of large polymerization molecules. So, a lot of Eigen's theory is around maintaining that kind of complexity. So what we wanted to show is that you don't need to passively be able to replicate a 95 nucleotide ribozyme. You can have much smaller ones, which are less complex, but ligation can put them all together. And when you start to get a network of all of these things, we wanted to develop this ribozyme as a starting point for getting a network going. That is important.
Okay, so if you understand the idea, okay, what is the possible pathway in the complex ribozyme, somehow retrosynthesize some of the lower complex.
That's true.
That's
and also
true.
Important to show that that this ligation is not template dependent.
Yeah,
so,
I'm just asking why that is
so the first conclusion that we had wasn't that surprising either. But the subsequent ones
So basically, when you need a template for any reaction, so the question is, how does if it uses something as a template, it has to first polymerize. It has to first polymerize, and then use that as a primer template to add something or perform any reaction. So when in primitive life, when there were no polymerases, efficient polymerases, or when there were no energy-rich compounds or something like that, then how simple reactions would have contributed to the increase in complexity? Because definitely the existence of replicases is still a big issue. So, you know, for a reaction to happen, use of a template is a high energy demanding process using a template. So if we are able to show that a reaction is not using a template, probably that could have been helpful in primitive life. Yes, we are studying the, you mean to say the kinetics? Yes. So you mean to say whether it's a 3' 5' phosphodiester bond or a 2' 5' phosphodiester? Yes. I agree with you. That is important. But as long as we are getting a string of nucleotides attached to each other, we are getting that nucleotide sequence, you know, because initially what was important was to increase the length of the molecule. And whether they were bound by each other by a 2' 5' phosphodiester bond or a 3' 5' shouldn't make a big difference, in my opinion. So although it's very important, we must know the chemistry of it, and my further work goes in exploring that chemistry.
I have a life question and a death question. So the life question is about, I just want to make sure I understand the technical details of the experiments that you just described, Nisha. So how do you eliminate the possibility that it is using part of itself as a template? And have you sequenced the section that it put onto the end to make sure that it actually added your template instead of making up something new?
No, I sequenced everything. Okay. So this is for sure that my substrate is not complementary to any region of the ribozyme, and all the products were sequenced.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, and then my death question, just quickly. Death is really important for morphogenesis in a lot of animal and plant systems. For death makes shapes of things. So in some systems like us, right, our hands. So do you know of any evidence for death in the organisms that you're working with, some of which have interesting complex multicellular morphologies? Any evidence for a role of death in creating those morphologies in your system?
We know a little bit about programming that's involved,
So I have a naive question that might be for you and also maybe for Niles too. So these are beautiful talks. I was thinking, you know, replication is very important for these early life molecules or RNA world type systems. Well, how about evolvability?
Sorry?
How about evolvability? In other words, these systems have to, I'm sure you must have thought about this, so I wonder if you have any comments about how to try to engineer or create the situations where you have a evolvable system. So I'd be interested in your response also. Niles, if you want to respond.
So you're talking about continuous evolution of molecules. So you mean to say that if we put like two molecules together, one molecule should be able to replicate the other one should be able to replicate this molecule.
Right, that's one way you can have it. That'll get you to sort of protein dimerization, codimers and so on.
I've not spent any appreciative time. So I don't know.
Because it is a fact that if you look at the protein families, a vast fraction of them are codimers and so on. And in fact, actually, again, Carl Rose wrote a paper back in the 70s proposing this sort of mechanism,
cycle.
Like something like a cyclical mechanism.
Yeah.
And at that time, actually, he didn't even know that.
I think Niall's work, I think I really appreciate his work. His work is some sort of the very first work which shows, you know, a self-evolving kind of a system using recombinase.
Right.
I wish it could be used in replicases or something like this, but it's pretty difficult to show in a system of replicases because, you know, they have to, as Pierre said, to take yourself as a template and to perform the catalytic function at the same time. It's a trade-off. So, yeah.
Well, I think in the system, I can't really speak to your system. I think your system has an innate sense of Darwinian evolvability just based on the selection scheme that you've used to isolate it. In the system that I've been working with, the evolvability is limited to sort of a network evolvability, and it's not sort of ingrained in the individual. Yeah, and so it's sort of a crude, I think Martin Nowak would describe it as pre-life, sort of a pre-life type of evolvability that's sort of loosey-goosey around the edges. But I think the network could evolve.
Just a somewhat technical question, but you use a specific substrate, but the ligation is substrate-specific, or you can ligate whatever you want to the end of your ribosome? I'm not clear about this point.
So the substrate is a DNA-RNA chimera. It has got four RNA nucleotides at its 3' end. It's not complementary to any part of the ribosome. It's just a random oligonucleotide.
And so any sequence will ligate as long, and you need this four DNA chimera, or that's just for the sequence?
No, you mean to say what's present at the 3' end? Like, we still to do that. I mean, what was important for us was that it is able to perform that function. We can further test on, you know, changing the oligonucleotide at the 3' end, like from A to U, U to G, G to C, and see whether it works or not. It's a random substrate, and there could be anything present at the primitive life, any kind of substrate.
Well, just a clarification question, but the informational complexity, you measure it by the number, the size of... Yeah, it's one. Okay, that's it.
How easy is it to poison the system, to kill it?
How easy is?
So this maybe is, how easy is it to break it? So these kind of systems, so how far away from the conditions that it works will it still work? So how robust it is to environmental perturbations, putting in ecology speak? the death one, I'm talking about the ligation.
So you mean to say how viable the system is?
So it works under the conditions you put it under, right? That works, and that's super great. And so if you make it conditions a little bit different, or a little bit more.
Well, I have tried that. I have.
Okay. All right.
So I have tried to use a couple of different buffer conditions. It works in every buffer condition.
Oh,
so
true.
All sorts of salt conditions. And it's a very, I can say it's a very general prebiotic ligase because it is resistant to all kinds of salt and buffer conditions.
That's great.
Well, if there are no further questions, I think let's thank the last speakers. I have a quick announcement before we adjourn. Of course, there's a conference dinner tonight at 6:30 in the courtyard, so you have about an hour. There's also, as Carl Simpson mentioned, he's organizing a after-hours group that will leave from the Best Western on foot. And the address of where they're going, it's called Break Time, is 5977 Encina Road. It's in Goleta. If you miss the group that's walking from the hotel, you can just use that address. All right. Any other announcements that you have? No? Okay. Thank you very much.